So to begin, I would like to remind people what we did last time, because last time I wrote a lot of equations with very little explanation, and I still write equations with very little explanation. At least I would like to give you the takeaway message. So when we discuss SUSY, the takeaway message is the following. So one, the U-covers and the gauge couplings of the standard model determine all marginal operators, marginal interactions, basically. Okay. Which means the following. So if I have the photon interaction, for example, with electron, I need to substitute two of the lines with supersymmetric particles. To get the selectron. So I substitute the electron with the selectron and the photon with the photino, supersymmetric partner. The couplings between the squarks, for example, what determines this diagram right here, this goes like y top squared. And so squark, Higgs couplings, and lepton, Slepton Higgs couplings set by U-covers. Okay. And the other important thing is that the Higgs quartic is set by the gauge couplings, which has a very important consequence that the prediction for the Higgs mass, it says, has to be less or equal than the mass of the Z, which is 90 GeV squared. And the question, which brings the questions, how come M Higgs measured is 125 GeV, if SUSY could be the theory of the world. On top of that, we've seen no new particles, okay? We've seen no new flavor violation, we've seen no new CP violation, we've seen no new LHC particles. So remember we discussed on Monday another hierarchy problem, the cosmological constant problem. Okay, which says that the energy density of the universe, which is usually denoted an energy density that has that's constant in the universe, and 65% of the energy budget of the universe is a number that's 120 orders of magnitude smaller, or 122 to be precise, smaller than the Planck mass. So where does this small number come from, okay? And the point is that another way to ask this question, if you draw the potential of the standard model, for example, the Higgs, you see that you can express this tuning by saying that the minimum of the energy of our theory, okay, is very close to zero. So this distance here, if this is zero, this is 10^120 in fundamental units of M Planck. If the universe was at the Planck scale, it would be tiny. It would be actually its size, if it's dominated by this number, it would be smaller than the size of the nucleus. So in that universe, you couldn't grow galaxies, you couldn't grow stars, it would be an empty, very boring universe, okay? And this has been the puzzle, in fact, for many, many years, in particular since they actually measured the number in the mid-90s. So for a while, people thought that it was zero for no reason. But when it was measured to be non-zero, then it made the problem even bigger. Weinberg, in fact, had identified this problem with papers in 87 and 88. And he said the following. Well, and there he said, he stated, and it's, these are famous papers where he stated, well, in fact, this is a problem that we have to worry about. And we don't have a dynamical solution for it. And in fact, he made the following funny argument that is not very popular, where he said that if I have a potential like this, well, if I have only one minimum, this is an accident. But let's imagine a theory where the potential kind of looks like this. So let's say that I have a theory that has many minima. The potential is very complex. Then it could be that by accident, I find myself in a region where the distance here is Planck to the fourth, okay? And if that happens, then by default, we will be there because that's the only places where galaxies can grow. And he called this the galactic, so people call this the galactic principle, okay? But people also call it the anthropic principle. And this is a word that people don't really like because it's like giving up. This is not a dynamical solution. This is just a historical accident that we end up being where we are, okay? And in fact, the interesting thing by doing this work, this argument, actually Weinberg made a prediction for the value of the cosmological constant. So Weinberg, by saying, okay, let's imagine that we have the matter content that we have, and let's require that the cosmological constant is only as large as it needs to be for galaxies to form. Because if we're much larger, it would pull galaxies apart before they even had time to form, and stars apart before they had time to form. So he actually calculated, given the measured of density of matter that we have, and he actually made in the 80s a prediction for the value of the cosmological constant of this minus 120 that was measured in the mid-90s. So his first paper, in fact, he wrote to counteract all of these arguments. He hated anthropics. So he wrote the first paper saying, oh, this is a stupid argument, cannot possibly work, and I will show it. And he ended up writing a paper that supported it. His 88 paper is a summary of all the dynamical solutions and how they fail. And in fact, he points out this idea again. Now, fast forward. So people still kept ignoring this problem, okay? So we have 120 orders of magnitude. In the meantime, all particle physicists worked on the Higgs hierarchy problem, which is only if you take the ratio, it's like 32 orders of magnitude. So in comparison, the Higgs hierarchy problem is really dwarfed by this problem. Now,
this hierarchy problem, the way that I understood it now, mm-hmm. is that like we have some value from like cosmological observation, mm-hmm. and this value is so fine-tuned.
Yes.
So it doesn't have any inconsistency with what we expect from a standard model?
It does, because the expectation from the standard model, for example, if you take the cutoff to be the Planck scale and you sum over all the ground state energies of all the modes, it's just this number, m Planck to the fourth.
So how does it solve it? Like how this solution that having many minimums can solve?
So by accident. So it solves this problem the same way that accidents happen in nature too, okay? So there is, for example, in nuclear physics, there is the binding energy of roughly every the binding energy of nucleons in the nucleus is like an MeV, 10 to the 6 EV, okay? And this comes out from the binding energy of the nuclei, the strong interactions, so people understand that number. Now, there are nuclei, though, where excitation energies accidentally find themselves to be very close. And for example, one such example is the thorium nucleus, 229, that has an energy splitting of 1 eV, which is atomic energies. Okay? Hello? We've started. So there, already by accident, because you have so many nuclei, by accident there are accidental cancellations that end up giving you that small number. Another such accident is the size of the moon relative to the size of the sun. So the size of the moon, so if you do every in every eclipse, the sun actually matches to very good accuracy the size of the moon, right? There is no dynamical reason for this. It just happens because we live on a planet like any other that has satellites. So the accident here is that if you have many vacua, and for them all the values of the cosmological constant varies for each one, by accident, just statistical accident, there's going to be at least one that has the right value that we measure. And we can only live there.
But doesn't it have any consequence on, like...
What?
I mean, this is too small for the atoms to come maybe.
No, so the atoms are not affected by this, but it does affect galaxies. So the argument is, the reason he got to this answer is that if it were any bigger, the cosmological constant, much bigger than this tiny number, it would, galaxies, because the interactions take time for them to cool, matter to fall into the wells and stars to, it wouldn't, they would be pulled apart before they even formed. Okay, does that make sense?
Well,
okay.
The initial expectation of the cosmological constant to be of order of
Planck. Yeah.
It was motivated by what we expected from a standard model.
Yeah, by calculation, the way we understand our calculations, exactly.
But now that it's too small, it doesn't have any inconsistency with the previous
calculation? No, it doesn't, because the calculation is not. So in every vacuum, you have to add different contributions, right? So in every, there's different probabilities, as like in the nucleus of the thorium nucleus. So most nuclei have energy splittings of MeV. But this is, you have to add the strong interaction energy, you have to the electromagnetic energy. And then when you add those two, sometimes they will accidentally cancel if you have too many nuclei with different properties. And this is what happens in the thorium nucleus. So there, instead of having an energy splitting that is characteristically of energy and MeV, you find something that's an EV. And in solids, it happens too. Like an example of tuning in this magic angle in graphene. Have you heard of this magic angle in graphene? So if you turn the graphene layers in a specific angle, you get all these funny properties. But that's a very special angle. It doesn't happen for any angle. So this is an example that if you have enough parameters, enough richness in your theory, which happens here if you have many vacua, somewhere by accident you will get cancellations and you will get a different value that you didn't expect to get.
So we can be...
You can only be there because that's the only place that will allow... We can only be there because that's the only place where we have galaxies that can form.
Can we expect to actually have a way to measure the cosmological constant or like vacuum energy from like particle physics experiments? That's what we're... No, no, well, we've measured this from cosmology, right? Yes, but we cannot measure
the different contributions. So in a way we've measured one contribution, which is the contribution coming from the electroweak phase transition, because there the energy of the potential of the Higgs changes by 10 to 60 orders of magnitude in this number. But that is a cosmology. So the point is that today we need to be here, okay? So there is no way to check this cancellation. But in nuclei, because we know all the physics that contributes to that energy, we can see that people have done calculations and see how if I were to change the fine structure constant, they saw that this untuning is undone, and then you see much larger variation of the levels. But we don't know enough. If we knew the structure of all the vacua and all the theory, we could in principle calculate where exactly. But we don't, right? Because we only live in one particular spot. Doesn't make sense? Okay. So, and in 2000, Busso and Polchinski, two string theorists, wrote a paper that said that such a structure naturally arises in string theory. In fact, people, when they came up with string theory to explain quantum gravity or anything like that, they were hoping that it will give them one master equation to describe, to unify everything together. And this 2000 paper actually gave the opposite example. And the way that comes about is because string theory has extra dimensions, okay? And because theory has extra dimensions, you need special dimensions, you need to make them small to give rise to our four dimensions that we see. In fact, string theory can have up to 10. So the extra six you need to make small. And the way you make them, the more complex it is, the more a structure like this you get. In fact, they found here that the number of vacua can be 10 to the 500. Okay? So which is a ridiculously high number. So this is what is known as the string landscape. And it caused quite a stir, this paper, and it changed a lot how people think about string theory. And the work, a lot of the people studied a lot during the 2000s. Inflation, the theory of inflation in the context of these theories. But the point is that, the key point is that this paper gave a natural place for Weinberg's idea to be realized in theoretical physics in a more, yeah.
Does this number correspond to the different geometries of the complexified dimension?
Yeah, it has to do with a number of scalar fields that you have in the theory. So if you have like two scalar fields, like the Higgs, for example, you have two vacua, okay? So you have one here. Let's say if you have n scalar fields, you have 2 to the n vacua. So this number here, n, corresponds to the number of moduli. They call them moduli. And this is roughly the number of scalar fields that you have. Okay? Yes?
In standard modeling, we saw that you have the X potential, but mm-hmm. ultimately decays.
Yeah.
That is different from this kind of model.
This is a subsection of that. So the Higgs here would be a tiny little part somewhere here. I don't know. So this is a much bigger structure. And the heights of the potential in this structure are so large that you cannot jump the way we jump from one Higgs vacuum, like unbroken phase to broken phase. So all this happens to extremely high energies. That's why it's more relevant for the theory of inflation. And at least that's the idea behind it, okay? I have to say this is not super popular, okay? I mean, people think about this type of arguments like giving up. But in reality, if you think about it, we've been through such a process before. So when people, so if now let's go back even before the 20th century, let's go back at the 16th century, okay? The time people thought, well, they kind of suspected that the Earth was going around the sun, but they thought the sun was really special, okay? And the stars were just bright lights at the vast, very far away sphere. And in fact, there was this guy, Giordano Bruno, who was a student of Galileo, that said, well, probably stars are exactly like the sun. So our sun is not special. So probably you have many Earths and you have many other, perhaps even civilizations, who knows. But we are not special at all. The stars are like another world, like our solar system. And the poor guy got toasted. They burned him at the stake for that statement. But of course, now we know through telescopes that stars are exactly like the sun. That had tremendous consequences. This is a picture like this. It's like each solar system is like a vacuum. Now, before people realize that stars are like the sun, one of the things you needed to do is to explain the shape and the size of planetary orbits. So in fact, there was the theory of epicycles. We're trying to people to explain, why is Venus there? Why is Mercury there? Why are we there? Why are we number three? And then the moment people realize that there are many things like the sun, well, it becomes a history. It's just an accident. We just happen to be, for example, in the right distance from the sun so that the Earth doesn't get scorched. So if we were much closer, it would get scorched and we couldn't be here. If it were too further away, it would be too cold to form life. Okay? So that created, and in fact, they used this when people look for exoplanets, they called it the Goldilocks zone, okay? So it's exactly this. So it no longer becomes a question of a dynamical theory. The people before needed a dynamical theory to explain why the solar system looks like it does. Now it becomes a historical accident. The Earth is not special, the solar system is not special, so we are just one, and we just happen to be in the planet that has the right conditions for us to be here. Okay? Now the question is, does this have any other implications? Because to say, oh, you have this guy and you tune it, I mean, it doesn't give you any experimental signatures, okay? So the question is, what more do you do? And this is where supersymmetry comes in. So the question is, back to supersymmetry, so you have these problems with the Higgs mass, you have the problems with the fact that we have found nothing, but at the same time, we know that we know that, one, it has gauge coupling unification. Okay. Two, because the lighter supersymmetric particle is stable, it also has dark matter. So can we solve all the problems of SUSY and at the same time preserve the successes? And this is where split supersymmetry comes in. And it was inspired by this idea from the landscape. Okay. So what is the idea of split SUSY? So split SUSY does the following, okay? So it says, let's say this is energy here. Before, in ordinary SUSY, we had the Higgs here, and it meant that if the Higgs was here, all the other particles needed to be the mass of the energy of the particles needed to be around the Higgs mass, okay? So you had the quarks, you have the photinos, and all the other SUSY particles have to be around the Higgs mass to explain the hierarchy problem, okay? Split SUSY does the following thing. It says, okay, turns out in this paper here, Busson and Polchinski also found that in order to get this large number of vacua, they needed to break supersymmetry at a very high scale, at the gut scale. Okay? So this is by an idea by Dimopoulos and Arkani Hamed. From 2004. And they say, okay, let's have the scalars, so quarks, leptons, the scalars of SUSY are, I don't know, at very high scales, above, at energies much larger than a TeV. Okay? Because they want to be at the SUSY breaking scale. So let's accept that the SUSY breaking scale is high. Now, they say, okay, the Higgs is tuned to be light in a way similar that the cosmological constant is tuned. And we can discuss what principle they use to explain that. So the Higgs is at 125, the one scalar that is tuned. And at around the TeV or below, in this region right here, you have the Giugino's, because, and the Higgsinos, because if you have fermions, they can be protected by chiral symmetry. And you need it to be at the TeV in order to give you dark matter, okay? So this is the model. Push all the scalar particles heavy and accept that there is tuning in the theory. But now make the Higgs light at 125 GeV to explain what I see. And the key point to their argument to explain why the Higgs is light is that coming from the atomic principle, okay? So what is the atomic principle? So now let's draw an axis here. Let's put the mass of the W, it doesn't matter, you can put it the mass of the Z or the mass of the Higgs, which is 80 GeV, we are here. And they said, okay, let's look at what happens at the mass of the neutron and the proton. If I start changing the weak scale, the mass of the W. So first of all, who can tell me what is heavier, the proton or the neutron?
The neutron.
Okay, great. By how much? A bit, yeah. A little bit. That's true. That's true. Yeah, they're really close. They're like two MeV away, almost. Like, they're really close in mass. Now, question for you. So if you have free neutrons, that means they decay to protons, okay? So why are neutrons stable in the nucleus? I mean, if there were neutrons inside nuclei were to decay, we wouldn't be around, just so you know.
The binding energy lowers
the energy. Yeah. So the electromagnetic energy of, because protons have positive charge, they repel each other. So their binding energy is less than the neutron energy, that only the neutrons get binded by the strong interactions. So that effective mass splitting inside the nuclei becomes much smaller, so you don't have enough energy to produce electrons. And the neutrons are stable inside nuclei. So it's the binding energy, exactly, electromagnetic energy that changes this mass difference, corrects this mass difference and gives you what we need to survive, which is cool. Okay, so we have the neutron here. And the proton, the neutron and the proton. Now, what happens if I make the weak VeV smaller? What happens to the masses? And what happens to the mass difference? So first of all, where does the proton and neutron mass difference come from? Like, where does the proton and neutron mass come from in general? Like, the first question. Be more precise. What happens to the strong interactions that doesn't happen to the other interactions? To the photons. What is special about QCD? Exactly. So that means that the QCD scale is what determines the mass of the hadrons, okay? So there is a minimum scale, and turns out that if you calculate the contributions from QCD to the quarks, it's roughly a GeV, okay? Now, there are small contributions coming from two sources, okay? One is the quark masses. So a proton is UUD, right? Primarily. And a neutron is DDU, okay? So what does this tell you? Well, because the down-type quark is slightly heavier, so M down is like 5 MeV, while M up is like 2.5, 2 MeV, okay? So you see here that if you sum up UUD, this contribution is 4 plus 5 is like 10 MeV, while for the neutron, this contribution is 10, 12, okay? So it's larger. Now, for the proton, there is one more contribution that has to do with the fact that it's charged. So there is a self-energy that goes like delta E, E and M, which goes like the fine structure constant over the size of the proton, which is like 200 MeV. So this is also roughly an MeV, okay? So now if you add everything up, it turns out that for the values that we measure, the neutron is slightly heavier than the proton. And it's such, the difference is such so that when you put them inside nuclei, the mass difference gets close and you cannot produce electrons, okay? So the neutrons are stable. So now the question for me to you, let's keep everything else in the theory fixed and I'm just changing the weak VEV. So given these things, what happens to them, to their masses and their mass difference as I make the weak VEV smaller? Yes. And then what happens? Let's say I decrease it by quite a bit. Let's say instead of 80 GeV, it's like 1 GeV.
We cannot have a stable atom.
Eh?
We cannot have a stable nuclear.
Why?
Because when mass difference decreases, then like that difference that was coming out from like electric binding energy cannot make the nuclear stable anymore.
So what is the process that makes the nuclei decay? You're in the right track, just so you know. What is the process? Do the math. So what will change from the mass contribution? So the QCD thing doesn't change, okay? So we don't change the QCD scale. But what do we change from the small mass corrections that I wrote up there?
You think would change and the small mass correction would change because of that. Exactly.
So what... Exactly. So what will change is the M up and M down, right? So they become less. Right? But what about the electromagnetic contribution? Does that change or not? It doesn't change, right? So that means that I make now what will happen? So they want to come closer in mass. And eventually, if I go here, and turns out this happens roughly at 20 GeV, what happens is, the proton becomes heavier and the neutron is lighter. So now the protons decay inside nuclei and you don't have atoms anymore. Okay? Now, let's go this way. So what happens if I go there? What happens if I make the weak scale larger?
Is
bigger,
yeah,
and the neutron can decay inside nuclei. So there is only one type of atom. What is the type of atom? No, come on, guys. What is the type of atom that has only protons?
Hydrogen.
Yeah, you only have hydrogen, so you don't have complex nuclei. Okay, so if you go here, so it turns out this happens at 400 GeV for the weak mass. If you go here, then you have neutron, too much mass difference, so it decays inside nuclei, and you have only hydrogen. And there you have no atoms. So if we want to be around, it means that the weak scale needs to be in this very narrow range. So this is what they call the atomic principle. And this, in fact, has been identified for quite some time, even before they wrote the supersymmetry paper, the split-Suzy paper. And they said, OK, it's an analogy similar to the cosmological constant. So the cosmological constant needed to be small for galaxies to form. We need the weak VEV to be small so that atoms can form and we can have complex life. Otherwise, if you don't have complex nuclei, you cannot have complex life. OK? So this is the principle that kept the Higgs heavy. And this had actually several consequences, OK? Did you guys play around with unification? Did they do the unification thing? Mm-hmm. Oh, OK. So now you know that when you write the run of the couplings, did you write it as x or alpha in the couplings?
X.
X, OK. So you have the inverse of the coupling. Basically, this is 4 pi over alpha. And this is the log of the energy. You see that if you have, this is x1, x2, x3. In the standard model, there is no unification. The two lines don't meet at the same point. While if you have Suzy, then you see if you add the particles at the TV scale, then you see that the lines change their trajectory and they unify at the right value. Okay? So they unify at a point now. Now the key observation is that because the quarks and leptons come in complete SU5 multiplets, they don't change the relative line between the couplings. Okay? So in fact, you only affect gauge coupling unification. You need the incomplete multiples, which are the gauge bosons and the Higgsinos and the Higgses. OK? So because this is exactly what supersymmetric split Suzy does, the scalars are not very important to get unification. You preserve gauge coupling unification. OK? So you have split here. This works very well. In fact, it works better than the ordinary Suzy. So you preserve one success. The Gieginos and Higgsinos are light, which means you have a dark matter candidate. So dark matter is also a hit. You explain dark matter. Now, what other properties does it have? So you saw here that the Higgs quartic in ordinary Suzy is set by the gauge couplings because of Suzy, of the Suzy relations. But we've broken supersymmetry, OK? And because we've broken supersymmetry, it means now that this coupling can get large contributions, radiative contributions. So for the Higgs mass, and quartic, the diagrams that we had before, these diagrams like this, where you have the top line in the loop, the Higgses here, plus diagrams that look like this, where you have the stop in the loop, you have the Higgs here, would correct the Higgs quartic by an amount that goes like 4 pi log m top squared. So you see that this is now a large number because I've made the stops very heavy. So I can change the quartic by quite a bit. Okay? So this is the change in the Higgs quartic. Can be quite large and correct for that mass discrepancy. So the fact that that you have the Higgs is 125 GeV can fit very well in split Suzy. And in fact, it tells you that for 125 GeV Higgs, it means that M stop, and because this is a log relation, has to be somewhere between 10 TeV and 1,000 TeV. Okay. So because now, so that means though that before in the original, in 2004, this is in 2012, okay? So because this is when we measured the Higgs mass. So before people thought, I mean, Savas and Nima, when they wrote down the paper, thought that the mass of the scalars can be very high, like 10 to the 12 GeV, almost to the God scale. But because of the Higgs mass measurement, it tells you that the Higgs, the scalars are not really that heavy as you thought. And they call this is mini-split. Okay? So this is a mini version of split. So you just split them by a little bit to explain the Higgs mass. And this is where the name mini-split comes from. So it turns out that this actually, now you see that this motivates built in a much higher, slightly higher energy collider than the LHC. So it tells you, well, you were just a tad bit unlucky. So you need to build another machine to actually find these guys that around 100 TeV would be perfect, okay? So now there is another thing that happens very nicely. So there is a plot here that, I mean, I wish I could show you. But if you put in an axis here, the mass of the scalars of SUSY, okay, and here you put the mass of the fermions of SUSY. This is where they are equal, okay, M scalar is equal to M fermion. Because we are in split, you have to live in this plane. Turns out that if you try to fit both the Higgs mass and get good unification, you find that the scalars have to be, again, between 10 TeV and 1,000 TeV. And then there is a little triangle like that. And getting the Higgs mass right. And then there is another line like this to get the Higgs mass right. And you have to live in this parameter space. And this range here for the fermions is like 1 TeV, around 1 to 10 TeV. Okay? So you see here that if the Higgs mass is correct and this idea of split SUSY is right, you will build a slightly higher energy collider at the LHC and everything's perfect. You will see this stuff. Now, the question is how are you gonna know that it is this split SUSY theory and it's not just, because what do you see? So far I've told you, okay, you've seen the Higgs and you've seen some random fermions that have random electroweak charges. So how would you know that it's split supersymmetry, okay? So it turns out there is a smoking gun, so-called signature for split supersymmetry, which is the following. So the heaviest, usually because of the way SUSY is broken, the heaviest of the fermions is usually the gluinos, the partners of the gluon, because those have the biggest charge. So they look like this. So you always produce them in pairs. So you have, so you have protons coming in at the LHC, you have stuff happening, and then you have a gluino here, another gluino here, and then they will start their cascade down to the, with quarks, and then they go to the LSP, to the lattice particle. Okay. So this is now the scalars, right? So this can be any quark here. But these guys are heavy, right? These are super heavy. So what does it mean for the decay rate of the gluino? So how much is that? Can someone estimate it for me? So what is the decay rate of the gluino in this theory?
1 upon mass root 4 of... S quark.
So you put, what do you put in the denominator again?
16 pi squared.
16 pi squared, okay.
Mass of q tilde pi 4.
Sorry, mass?
Of q tilde.
Q tilde to what power?
4.
Okay, and here?
With mass of Luino 5.
Great. That's really good. That's really good. There is, of course, the two powers of the strong coupling, the coupling here. So you have, let's say, a G, here's G3, and this is some coupling G. So G3, G squared here. Now, there is one more factor. It's not just 16 pi squared, OK? So this is a subtle point. So if you have a two-body decay, so if you have one particle going to two, there's a phase space factor that's 1 over 4 pi. If you have three, and this is three, you have one, two, three particles, okay? This is 192 pi cubed, okay, this phase space factor. Turns out it's like roughly 1 over 4 pi times 1 over 16 pi squared. So this one be almost perfect. The only thing it needs is this, okay, to get the right estimate. And it matters, 4 pi is 10, okay? So it matters. But remember, every time you add a particle in the decay, you get an additional loop factor. So the first two as 1 over 4 pi, any additional particle is a loop factor, just for your estimates, okay? There is a, you know, Jackson's E&M? Yeah, the same Jackson wrote this book, this paper that discusses the phase space factors. And in fact, as you calculate properties at the LHC where you have many final states, phase space factors become very hard to calculate. So this is where, and when I was a postdoc at Berkeley, David Jackson was still alive. So I learned this from him. So so you see this guy is very long lived. So if you plug in the numbers, and if you take into account that now you have this mini split where the scalars are between 10 TeV and 1,000 TeV, you find that the Gluino lifetime is somewhere between decaying promptly. So the lifetime can be basically prompt for collider life timescales, or smaller than roughly 10 to the minus 9 seconds, which is the, sorry, I don't remember this number. Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's the proper. So the decay length of the Gluino goes like 3 times 10 minus 2 meters times 1 TeV for the Gluino mass to the fifth power, and then Sam Suzy T to the fourth TeV, the fourth here. So the point is that this is like a few centimeters, okay? So because Gluinos at the LHC are produced slightly boosted, you will see the charge. So the Gluino first is produced, and then you see these charged particles decay. So the decay will appear slightly displaced. They will travel some time inside the detector before they decay, which is a funny, very funny signature. So that usually doesn't happen. Okay, so this is what is known as smoking gun of Split Suzy. And this is, in fact, at the LHC, if you go and look for displaced Gluino searches, they're basically inspired by split supersymmetry, okay, and this type of signature. In fact, it's very interesting. There is a little slightly part of the parameter space. So these Gluinos are charged, are colored, right? So when you have a free propagating particle colored, it cannot carry color. You have confinement. So they get dressed with quarks and perhaps another gluon, and they create what are known as R hadrons. So these R hadrons can stop inside the detector. So if the lifetime, if M Suzy was much larger than this, the lifetime, the sita would be even longer. So what would happen is they would stop inside the detector. They would lose all of their energy. And suddenly, they would just decay sometime when the detector was not running. So people have done searches like that, too, which is a very funny thing, to have some random decay energy coming to you. So this is what is known as a smoking gun of split supersymmetry. This property is not from any other well-motivated theory. This doesn't happen. So this is good. Now there is one more thing, and then we finish with this, is that, so as I told you before, for ordinary SUSY, as we have there, the couplings of the Higgsinos and the Bino to the Higgs, for example, H up, and then you have the corresponding coupling to H down, and the coupling, for example, to the W here. So these couplings here, in ordinary supersymmetry, these are related to the gauge coupling. So this is basically proportional to G1 up to some like square root of 2 or something. And this is G2, okay, because they are related to the gauge invariance and they're fixed by SUSY. Now, because SUSY is broken at high scales, at low energies, this won't have the same values. So there is another type of unification you can look for. So if you were to plot, now let's call this coupling kappa, and let's call kappa 1 and kappa 2. So you will see that if you take kappa 1 ratio to G1, you will see that at some point, it will go to 1 at higher energies if you run it with log E. And then same thing will happen for kappa 2. So you will have some other line. And then this will be kappa 2 over G2. It will run to 1 at the scale of SUSY breaking. OK? So what this tells you is that there is another type of unification related to gauge coupling unification that points to the exact scale of SUSY breaking. Once you're able to measure the electroweakinos, discover these particles, and see that the couplings unify to the scale. With this, I will finish. So the bottom line is that even though we haven't found SUSY yet, and it looks very bleak, it looks like there are well-motivated ideas that tell you that it's just beyond the reach of the LHC. And they came out before the LHC found nothing, okay? That's very important because we didn't cook it up after the LHC found nothing. So these are ideas from 2004, in fact, suggested that, in fact, it's still motivated to actually build a bigger machine, a more energetic machine. There's still perhaps potential for discovery. So on Monday, I will talk about a completely different approach to the hierarchy problem. So far, what we were trying to do was take things like the quadratic divergences of the Higgs and say we add something, anything, so that this is TV squared and not lambda UV squared, so that we desensitize the theory to the UV cutoff. So on Monday, we'll discuss theories that actually bring the cutoff low at the TEV of the theory, so that you, whatever you do to the theory has to happen, everything has to happen at the TEV. OK? And that's it. Thank you, guys.